Elephants face a tough road in the wild. They're not the only creatures facing threats, but what sticks out of an elephant's face, ivory tusks, makes it so much more attractive dead than alive for people who see an economic value in the animals. Fortunately, lots of people are just plain fascinated by these largest land animals, fascinated enough to study them and protect them. Caitlin O'Connell is one of the people who studies them. She's a consulting assistant professor in the Department of Otolaryngology, Head and Neck Surgery at Stanford University School of Medicine. She obviously takes a great interest in elephants, spends a lot of time with them in Africa, and has written several books about them, including a novel, a thriller, about a wildlife biologist investigating a crime. Caitlin O'Connell, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, well, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Let's start there, but with the novel. Does the protagonist of Ivory Ghosts say and do some things you feel you can't do in helping protect elephants?
Well, the desire to write a novel kind of was born out of the idea that I've written a lot of nonfiction about elephants, and I wanted to reach a broader audience and touch people who might not have an interest in elephants, but they like to read mystery thrillers. And Catherine Sohan, the main character here, her experiences are based on my own experiences and kind of an amalgam of people around me. So it represents what's really going on in Africa, but it allows you to be entertained at the same time. That was the goal of the book, and now I'm just finished the sequel. It's set in China, and it continues the wildlife crime adventure.
Oh, that sounds great that you got there, because so you're talking about where the market for ivory is.
Yes, and the idea is to really educate people broadly, both in China and in the U.S. and in Africa, as to the importance of elephants in our world and how crazy the ivory situation has become. I mean, there's an estimate now that 96 elephants a day are being killed for their ivory, and it just has to stop. And I'm trying in a lot of different ways to build awareness, and so writing this thriller was a way to broaden the audience.
Let's talk about your career track, Caitlin. You are working at a medical school, but not an MD. You're a PhD with degrees in other sciences. How did you end up looking into elephants and yet still working in a medical school?
Well, my real interest is in long-distance communication and low-frequency hearing, along with animal behavior, and we'll talk about elephant behavior. But low-frequency hearing is something that's very important in medicine and understanding human hearing. And our hearing, the first thing we lose is our high-frequency hearing. And so there's a lot of interest in understanding other animals that have low-frequency hearing to pair against humans. So, for example, we study mice to understand human hearing, and our hearing range is much more similar to an elephant than it is to a mouse. So by studying another animal that has low-frequency hearing helps us understand our own low-frequency hearing and our vibrotactile sense. So the show that's going to air on Sunday night at 9 p.m., Mind of a Giant, highlights some of my research showing that elephants have a very keen vibrotactile sense. So their feet are very sensitive to vibrations and can detect vocal signals that couple with the ground. They can detect those signals in their feet. And so how does that relate to human medicine? Well, we also have the sense to detect vibrations in our fingertips, our feet, our lips. But normal hearing humans don't really focus on vibrations as a form of communication. But people with hearing impairments, vibrations are a very important part of their world and communicating. And so we've developed a vibrotactile hearing aid based on that concept. And so that's why I'm in the Department of Otolaryngology, Head and Neck Surgery at Stanford, because I'm applying what we know from other species to human medicine.
In the case of the elephants with their vibrotactile sense, I mean, how far away can they communicate or at least hear what other elephants are doing?
Well, we've done a number of studies on this, one playing back vocalizations through the ground in the wild and watching their responses and understanding how sophisticated their ability to discriminate between call types based on the call structure, so they can discriminate very fine frequency differences. And what that means at a short-term and a long-distance measure means that they have a much larger range for communication and a different channel for communicating. Vibrations across the surface of the Earth don't have an outer limit as acoustic signals do. There's a physical property called Snell's Law where acoustic signals refract back into the atmosphere after 10 kilometers. Well, seismic signals don't have that outer limit, so there's a potential for their communication range to be much, much broader in the ground than it might be in the air.
Wow. Elephants are the topic here on the Jefferson Exchange. Caitlin O'Connell's a researcher at Stanford University. Her program, she's part of a program on the National Geographic Wild Channel called Mind of a Giant. That's premiering Sunday, June 19th at 9 in our time zone. You can join us on the Exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. How old were you when you took your first trips to Africa to see the elephants in person?
24. I just finished my master's in seismic communication and insects at University of Hawaii. And my husband and I spent a year traveling in Africa and then got this position because we were volunteering in Etosha National Park, Namibia. We were offered a job to look at elephant movements and interaction with humans and their communication patterns through the Namibian government. It was a three-year position. And from there, it became a lifetime pursuit. They're you know, a long-lived, intelligent, social animal that it's become a lifetime job for me.
Can we assume you've never gone back to the insect research?
Well, I'm always fascinated by any kind of communication, and insects have, you know, fascinating different kinds of adaptations, particularly. So I haven't lost my interest in insects, but I apply what I've learned from insects to elephants.
So over the 20 plus years that you've been researching elephants, do you have a real sense for what they're doing, how they're communicating with each other? I mean, can you get inside the mind of the giant yourself, I guess, is the question?
Well, I've certainly tried. Unfortunately, we can't lie them on the psychiatric couch and ask them how they're feeling
right.
Or what they're experiencing, but we can kind of set up experimental parameters to ask these questions. And in my early days, I was studying long-distance communication, and then that, because I've had to focus on their very, very subtle behaviors and responses, over time, I got more interested in how they communicate with each other at close range and how tactile communication and body language plays a really important role in their world and how they communicate and how they structure their families and their dominance hierarchies. And that's what Elephant Don is really about, my latest book that comes out in paperback next month with University of Chicago Press. The fact that male elephants have such a ritualized social environment, and it's very similar to a mafioso situation where you approach the don and you kiss the ring and then you step back and the next one approaches the don. With elephants, the trunk to mouth ritual behavior is very similar to the handshake. But it's also very similar to kissing the ring in terms of how to approach a dominant individual. There's a whole body language that comes with this where they kind of drop their shoulders and approach in a very supplicating way. And then sometimes with trepidation, their trunk is shaking a little bit as they place their trunk in the dominant bull's mouth. And then they step off and it seems like they have this release that, okay, they've greeted the don. And now they can go on with their drinking. So it's fascinating to see how similar the rituals are between male have become very interested in tactile and tactile communication and body language.
All right, I want to let our listeners know there's nothing wrong with their radios or their internet connections. We did lose you for a couple seconds twice now, but you came back both times, so we'll just wait through it. Other than that, you sound fine. Caitlin O'Connell, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, Stanford University elephant researcher, 800-838-3760. If you'd like to join us by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Given the things that you've been able to figure out and interpret in elephant behavior, it seems like you would, by necessity, have to spend a lot of time around individual elephants understanding differences in their behavior from time to time.
Yes. We have a permanent field site in Natasha National Park, Namibia, where we go. We've turned to the same site, and the elephants are resident at that waterhole, and we're able to come back and kind of catch up where we left off the previous year and see who's dominant to whom and how family interactions are playing out, what's going on in the male world, and what happens when a dominant individual disappears. How do they restructure their society? It's been a fascinating 25-year ride, and I look forward to continuing the journey.
It's quite a power struggle, isn't it, when the dominant male is gone?
It is. We actually did another documentary about that called Elephant King with Smithsonian Channel, and it is fascinating to get the opportunity to remove a kingpin and see how the rest of the power structure fills in that space. And, you know, in the wild, when you have social animals, it's long-lived social animals, it's sometimes hard to figure out how that might happen and how long a dominant male stays at the top of the hierarchy and then what happens, you know, if he's temporarily wounded. All the different power struggles that happen in this intervening time is really fascinating. I think also in Mind of a Giant, that airs Sunday night on Nat Geo Wild, we see the story is framed around an old bull, a huge tusker, kind of an iconic figure in Kenya, and to me really highlights the importance of having these older males in the society, these sentient beings, where in our experience watching elephants, the young bulls really get a lot out of these older bulls. Sometimes the older bulls are extremely social and have little bulls following them that have just left their family group. So male elephants leave their families between 12 and 15 years of age. It's kind of a coming of age where the females are saying, okay, it's time to go now. They've had enough of their trouble inside the family. But it's also for them, they want their independence, but then it's really hard to leave family because they grew up in such a social environment. So they really seek social interaction in this next phase of life. So they look for males that are willing to be social with them. And most of the male population, at least in our study area, are very social and want to have these long-term relationships, and so these older bulls are really important mentors to these young bulls. And watching this show is to me a reminder of how important it is to have older males in the society, and not just for us as tourists going over to see these amazing iconic figures and the huge tuskers, but also to the younger male elephants in the society and how important that is. The show also showcases a lot of the cutting-edge research of many prominent elephant researchers today, and so it's exciting to piece together elephant intelligence from all of these different studies.
The channel is Nat Geo Wild, as Caitlin mentioned, and the special part of the Destination Wild series is called Mind of a Giant. That'll start Sunday at 9 on Nat Geo Wild. Let's take a call here. It's Bill in Arcata. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Caitlin O'Connell.
Thank you. About 1974, I read that animals' hearing is tuned to the size of their head so that the optimal hearing is about the wavelength that the head can block to optimize directional hearing, and that's why different size animals are tuned to different wavelengths of sound. And I wondered if Professor O'Connell had any comments on that.
All right. Thanks for that, Bill. Appreciate it.
Well, that's a very good question. Statement. Elephants, their low-frequency signals are produced at 20 hertz, and that is a 17-meter-long wave. And so the question has always been, how can they localize this signal? And their ears are about a half a meter apart from ear canal to middle ear. And so there is a very large head, and that will facilitate the wavelength difference hitting one side of the head to the other. But the problem is low-frequency sounds are omnidirectional because these wavelengths are so long. So the phase angle, if you stretch, imagine a string, a 17-meter-long string, and then having that string cycle, it's very, very difficult to discriminate an angle in that wave. And so that's why an elephant head, it's easier for an elephant to do that than a mouse, for example. It would be impossible in their high-frequency ear. So, yes, it is true that a larger head will be able to detect phase angles much better for localization, which is how we do it also. But it's still very difficult to localize a 17-meter wave and how you would detect where that was coming from through phase angle. So one of the other modalities that we show in Mind of a Giant is that the vibration sense facilitates their detection of a signal, and it might facilitate it more from the point that you're making. In the ground, an elephant vocalization is only 12 meters long as opposed to the 17-meter sound wave, and that's simply because of the velocity of the sound in the soil versus the air. I'm going to get into a little bit of physics here with this, so bear with me, but a sound propagating in the air travels at 344 meters per second, and that's pretty standard unless you're... That's a standard sound in air, but in the ground, sounds have different velocity based on the soil type. And so in our environment in Namibia, the sound in the ground travels at 250 meters per second, and so that gives you a shorter wavelength, and the signals between or signal receivers of the front foot and the back foot of the elephant give you a much longer detectable range, so you can detect a phase angle much better between the front and back leg of a 12-meter signal versus in the air with a half a meter and 17-meter wavelength. I hope I have been able to address that question.
We're in awe of the complexity a lot going on there to help the elephants know what's going on around them. To the major issue facing elephants, we're still haunted by a chat we had a year ago with the head of the forensics lab in Ashland, who said that things don't look good for elephant survival. What do you think?
Well, at the moment, it looks really bleak with this statistic that 96 elephants a day are being shot for ivory. And I want to remain hopeful as well that we can turn things around. We have the power to turn things around, and we need to turn things around. It's a very urgent matter. Having this show really, I hope, brings it home to people that the importance of elephants, not just because of their intelligence, but they're these magnificent animals in our environment, and we should want them to stay in this world. And it is at the moment things look bleak, but there are between 300 and 400,000 elephants left in Africa, and we would like to keep it that way. Partly through maintaining their habitat and partly by stopping the poaching.
How well equipped is Namibia, where you do most of your work, or any country for that matter, to hold off the poachers?
Well, in Namibia at the moment, elephants aren't as targeted as the black rhino is. There's a very large population of black rhino in Namibia relative to other countries, and it's an open desert environment, so it's a big security challenge, and they're getting all the help that they can from international nonprofits, supporting additional security, and elephants as well in the northeast of the country, the Zambezi region. They've been a target, and they're doing everything they can to increase security and police intelligence to really shut down these channels. And that was, again, one of the reasons I wrote Ivory Ghosts, the thriller about the ivory trade, was because of the smuggling ring that was going on in the early 90s when we were working in that region, and just the characters involved, the dedication of people that are risking their lives on a daily basis to save elephants is really inspiring. And, you know, really, it can take just one individual to make a difference. And if we all have that in mind and keep that in mind, that each one of us can make a difference in any way we can, that it's worth doing.
Caitlin O'Connell is a scientist who spends a lot of time on elephant research. She is based at the Department of Otolaryngology, Head and Neck Surgery at Stanford University's School of Medicine, because she's been able to, as you heard, apply some things learned from elephant hearing to human hearing and remedies for human hearing problems. The program on TV that we're talking about is called Mind of a Giant. It's part of the Destination Wild series on Nat Geo Wild, premiering this Sunday, June 19th at 9 in our time zone. Caitlin O'Connell, best of luck with the program, and thanks for joining us in the exchange today.
Well, thanks so much, and I hope people enjoy the show. Thank you.
All right, take care.